The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
And it's a Monday. Welcome to it. I think I'm booming out. YouTubers are going to have to tell me if my mic is too hot. I was playing around with, I had some issues. You know, it's a Monday. Everything is kind of foobar. So I was messing with my levels and stuff. But so I'll leave it up to you guys to let me know. You be my producers out in the field. And let me know this. It sounds like it's like coming in and out. I'm gonna have to play with it a little bit. Anyway, I will do it as the show progresses, unless you tell me that there's a distinct problem which I need to fix immediately. So, happy Monday, I guess. It is Monday, and I'm feeling like I've got those old Monday blues again. And it's got nothing to do with music, and it's got nothing to do with the day of the week. What it is, I'm afraid, is that new administration smell is wearing off and the stench is coming in. Yeah, there's quite a few things that I'm not so happy with the Biden administration about, and we're going to get into a lot of that today. There's a lot of news, and I guess I should go with the big news story that broke. I'm trying to remember if it broke. It did. Actually, there are two stories. One broke just as I was finishing up my What's News segment, and I had to edit it to get this story in because this is a big one. The Supreme Court today announced it will hear a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. We knew this was coming. The court will review Mississippi's ban on abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. 15 weeks. That is prior to the point of viability. In other words, the fetus cannot live outside the womb at 15 weeks. It's just too early. I mean, there was so much talk about the 20-week bans. And at 20 weeks, they're still really not viable, but some have survived. And so in Mississippi, a law that has been blocked by the lower courts since it was enacted in 2018, but they keep appealing it, and now it's going to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is taking it on. This will be the first major reproductive rights case argued before the high court since Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed. And you know what Amy Coney Barrett wants. She wants to make it so that you can't ever have an abortion. You know, and it kills me to hear Republicans using to defend their choice not to get a vaccine, my body, my choice. Well, that's not what it was meant for. It's not about that. And no, you know what? It's when it comes to, I guess it is your choice when it comes to getting a vaccine. It's also my choice to not be in a place where you are if you're not vaccinated. But so now it's six right-wing Republican conservatives and three justices appointed by Democrats. I can't even say liberals on the court. Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Stephen Breyer. Those are the three. And frankly, none of them are liberal. And if they were, they wouldn't have gone along with that horrible ruling decision just a few weeks ago about ownership rules for local broadcast medium. There was another piece of news that did not make it into my newscast because it broke afterwards. Matt Gaetz's buddy, you know, the former Seminole County, Florida tax collector, a guy named Joel Greenberg, the one who, you know, Matt Gaetz skeezed around with. Well, he pleaded guilty today to multiple crimes, including sex trafficking of a 17-year-old girl and bribery. And this deal likely increases legal troubles for Matt Gaetz, because apparently in the 60-page plea deal, most of those 60 pages is Joel Greenberg ratting out his friends, other people like Matt Gaetz. And so what blows my mind is that Matt Gaetz is still hanging out in Congress. As far as I know, he hasn't been taken off any committees. He hasn't been reprimanded by leadership. He's just going about his own business. But yeah, Joel Greenberg pleaded guilty to 6 criminal counts in a case that sparked a federal investigation into whether or not Matt Gaetz paid girls for sex. Matt Gaetz has denied any wrongdoing. He said he's never paid for sex. And it's not even about paying for sex. It's about paying minors for sex. Well, and paying for sex is illegal still. And transporting them across state and even international lines. I don't deal with this story a lot because, frankly, it doesn't impact you and me. Although me, maybe more than you because I live in Florida. But then again, he's not my congressman. Matt Gaetz' district in the panhandle of Florida is the most conservative district in Florida and one of the most conservative districts in the country. So go figure. They deserve each other. All right. Well, we're just getting started, and I see the phone is already ringing, and it's a familiar person on the other line. It's my husband, David, calling. Hello.
Hi, darling. So you mentioned this abortion ruling that potentially could come down. That will affect an awful lot of people, including the handmaidens in our society. And I'm wondering if Trump's latest handmaiden, Ms. Stefanik, will be utilizing the service.
Uh-oh. Oh, you just got cut off, David. What happened? I guess I can call him back. I don't know. I don't know what happened, but I'll call him back. Premature ending of the call.
Hello?
Hi, what happened?
I don't know. All of a sudden, I got a call from your number.
Yeah, here. No, you got cut off. All of a sudden, the line went dead.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Okay, so what was the last thing you heard me say?
You're wondering if Trump's latest handmaiden in Elise Stefanik is going to be somehow impacted by this abortion ruling? What?
I asked if she was going to be utilizing Huckaboo-Boo's makeup therapy.
Oh, she already did. Yeah.
Her recent appearances, she's not wearing cocktail dresses.
She's
not wearing fake eyelashes.
I don't know. I didn't see it, but I did see a lot of comments about her when she stood up after she was voted in, that she obviously used Huckaboo-Boo's makeup artist because she all of a sudden had it slathered on.
Makeup therapist.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Also, I'm trying very hard to develop herd immunity. That's H-E-A-R-D immunity. Immunity to bullshit that I've heard these fucking maggots throwing out lately.
Uh-huh. Is it working for you?
I'm trying. I'm not giving up yet.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't have that herd immunity.
Love you, bye.
All right. Love you too. Bye. All right. So there's the husband, David. In case you were wondering, by the way, I should mention that Thursday, this coming Thursday, I will be taking the day off because it's David's birthday. And so we're going to go out for the first time in over a year. We are actually going to go out to dinner to a place where we can sit outside and eat. But still, we are going to go out to dinner and we're probably going to go to the art show with Rick Allen in Fort Lauderdale that we talked about on Friday. I hope you got to hear that on Friday's overtime. But today, so let me tell you what's going on today. I'm obviously, you know, I say I got the Monday blues. It's not a Monday thing, and it's not just the blues. It's, again, that new administration smell is wearing off. So not only is this shit happening in Israel? And Joe Biden's response is just flat out wrong. I'm sorry. Let me share with you this little tidbit, because this is making me really angry. So the two different groups of senators released statements this weekend calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. But Joe Biden has declined to do the same. He hasn't called for a ceasefire. Not only that, the UN Security Council called for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, and the Biden administration reportedly blocked it. Biden is staying vocally supportive of Israel despite growing opposition from within the party, from all over the country and the world, frankly, over the Israeli army's daily barrage of attacks on Palestinian civilians. Again, I can be critical of Israel without being anti-Semitic. I'm Jewish. I'm an atheist, but I'm Jewish. And I'm proud of my heritage. But I am not proud of what Israel is doing today. I think it's sickening. And I hate that the United States is aligned with that shit. And I appreciate the fact that so many are speaking out. So in the Sunday New York Times, Bernie Sanders had an op-ed that I'm going to share with you. Again, this ran yesterday. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This ran Friday, May 14th in the New York Times. I just saw it yesterday. Bernie Sanders wrote, "Israel has a right to defend itself." These are words we hear from both Democratic and Republican administrations whenever the government of Israel, with its enormous military power, responds to rocket attacks from Gaza. Let's be clear. No one is arguing that Israel or any government does not have the right to self-defense or to protect its people. So why are these words repeated year after year, war after war? And why is the question almost never asked, what are the rights of the Palestinian people? And why do we seem to take notice of the violence in Israel and Palestine only when rockets are falling on Israel? In this moment of crisis, the United States should be urging an immediate ceasefire. We should also understand that while Hamas is firing rockets into Israeli communities is absolutely unacceptable, today's conflict did not begin with those rockets. Palestinian families in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah have been living under the threat of eviction for many years, navigating a legal system designed to facilitate their forced displacement. And over the past few weeks, extremist settlers have intensified their efforts to evict them. And tragically, those evictions are just one part of a broader system of political and economic oppression. For years, we have seen a deepening Israeli occupation in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and a continuing blockade on Gaza that make life increasingly intolerable for Palestinians. In Gaza, which has about 2 million inhabitants, 70% of young people are unemployed and have little hope for the future. Further, we have seen Benjamin Netanyahu's government work to marginalize and demonize Palestinian citizens of Israel, pursue settlement policies designed to foreclose the possibility of a two-state solution, and pass laws that entrench systemic inequality between Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel. Now, none of this excuses the attacks by Hamas, which were an attempt to exploit the unrest in Jerusalem, or the failures of the corrupt and ineffective Palestinian Authority, which recently postponed long overdue elections. But the fact of the matter is that Israel remains the one sovereign authority in the land of Israel and Palestine. And rather than preparing for peace and justice, it has been entrenching its unequal and undemocratic control. Over more than a decade of his right-wing rule in Israel, Mr. Netanyahu has cultivated an increasingly intolerant and authoritarian type of racist nationalism. In his frantic effort to stay in power and avoid prosecution for corruption, Mr. Netanyahu has legitimized these forces, including Itamar Ben-Gvir and his extremist Jewish power party, by bringing them into the government. It is shocking and saddening that racist mobs that attack Palestinians on the street of Jerusalem now have representation in its Knesset. These dangerous trends are not unique to Israel. Around the world, in Europe, in Asia, in South America, and here in the United States, we've seen the rise of similar authoritarian nationalist movements. These movements exploit ethnic and racial hatreds in order to build power for a corrupt few rather than prosperity, justice, and peace for the many. For the last 4 years, these movements had a friend in the White House. At the same time, we're seeing the rise of a new generation of activists who want to build societies based on human needs and political equality. We saw these activists in American streets last summer in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. We see them in Israel. We see them in the Palestinian territories. With a new president, the United States now has the opportunity to develop a new approach to the world, one based on justice and democracy. Whether it's helping poor countries get the vaccines they need, leading the world to combat climate change, or fighting for democracy and human rights around the globe, the United States must lead by promoting cooperation over conflict. In the Middle East, where we provide nearly $4 billion a year in aid to Israel, we can no longer be apologists for the right-wing Netanyahu government and its undemocratic and racist behavior. We must change course and adopt an even-handed approach, one that upholds and strengthens international law regarding the protection of civilians, as well as existing U.S. law holding that the provision of U.S. military aid must not enable human rights abuses. This approach must recognize that Israel has the absolute right to live in peace and security, but so do the Palestinians. I strongly believe that the United States has a major role to play in helping Israelis and Palestinians to build that future. But if the United States is going to be a credible voice on human rights on the global stage, we must uphold international standards of human rights consistently, even when it's politically difficult. We must recognize that Palestinian rights matter. Palestinian lives matter. Again, that is Bernie Sanders, American Jew, Bernie Sanders, who wrote that op-ed for the New York Times. And yes, I agree with every word of it. Man, he should be president. I'm just saying, he should be president, but he's not. I'm going to play for you one other clip. And this was Ali Velshi, who happens to be my favorite person on MSNBC. I don't watch a whole lot of that channel these days. I do watch Ali Velshi because he is very good. And this is the reason that I watch that. Stuff like this.
Let's make one thing clear. Israel has a right to exist and to defend itself. That is an indisputable fact.
Yep.
But so do Palestinians. And that's a fact that's often ignored. Palestinians are, at best, third-class citizens in the nation of their birth. The idea that it's even remotely controversial to call what Israel has imposed on Palestinians a form of apartheid is laughable. One look at a current map of Israel, Gaza, and the occupied territories conjures up only one other example, apartheid-era South Africa. The Israeli government, on an ongoing basis, declares parcels of land on which Palestinians live to be either of military or archaeological importance, causing residents to be evicted. Sometimes there's a court case, and almost always the Palestinians lose. Yet months or weeks later, that same important land suddenly becomes home to a brand new Israeli settlement. As more and more Jewish settlers take over land on which Arabs live, the occupied West Bank becomes de facto more Israeli and, in the explicit hopes of the Israeli government, more Jewish. This is a long-standing attempt and a deliberate attempt to force Arabs who have lived in that land sometimes for hundreds of years out. It's an attempt to dilute their presence because to have Arabs as full participants is, in the opinion of the Israeli government and their courts, diluting Israel. Just prior to the pandemic, I toured many of the contested areas and homes from which Arabs are being pushed out, both in Israel proper and in the occupied territories. Palestinians don't control the important parts of their lives. Palestinian families are refused permits to build or renovate their homes. When they connect their homes to the municipal water supply, Israeli soldiers sometimes cut the pipes. When they attempt to harness solar energy because their homes are not on the grid, Israeli soldiers literally come and remove solar panels from their homes.
That's fucked up.
I spent an hour and a half traveling alongside an elderly Palestinian woman who was being transferred between three ambulances from Gaza to the no man's land in between and then into Israel to get cancer treatment.
Wow.
Three ambulances over the course of 1 mile, more than an hour to cross the border. That's how Gazans live. Without medical treatment because Israel prevents it. Without electricity much of the time because Israel prevents it. Without the ability to fish in the Mediterranean Ocean because Israel prevents it. Without an airport or a seaport because Israel prevents it. Like Israelis, Palestinians also have a right to exist and to defend themselves. But there is no one willing to help them do that. Not the Israeli courts and not the U.S. government. What the U.S. also shares with Israel is the belief that Hamas, the political party that governs Gaza, is a terrorist organization that calls for the destruction of Israel.
Yeah.
Hamas is supported by the majority of Palestinians in Gaza. Hamas may not be in the best long-term interests of the Gazans, but peace hasn't really worked out for them. Faced with an Israeli government which pens them into what has been called the world's largest open-air prison, they have chosen a government that most of us wouldn't prefer, one that is not given to negotiation and moderation and respect for its neighbor. Israel needs a new approach to the Palestinians, and America needs a new approach to Israel.
No kidding.
After more than 7 decades of not just being deprived of land from which they were evicted, Palestinian frustration runs deep. It may be worth going deeper than what you may hear inside your bubble and understanding the depth to which the Palestinian people are subject to apartheid in their own land, deprived of basic necessities, and subject to relentless civil rights violations. This is not a secret. It's out there for you to see. You just have to look for it.
Mm. That's Ali Velshi, and that's why I watch his show. He is that good. You know, I had him on the program not too long ago. It was a while ago now. Maybe I'll rerun that on Thursday. In fact, I told you I'll be out Thursday. So if you have any requests, an interview you'd like to hear repeated, shoot me an email or tweet at me. I'm on Twitter at Nicole Sandler. You can email me Nicole@NicoleSandler.com. Because he makes sense. And yet we have, you know, Joe Biden today. He was supposed to speak a few hours ago to Netanyahu and then was going to have a statement afterwards. I haven't heard anything about it. I'm looking at my my email feed right now to see if there's anything there, and I'm not seeing anything. So, nope, nothing. No news on a phone call between Biden and Netanyahu today. All I know is, you know, Donald Trump and Netanyahu were in bed together for years. They're birds of a feather and all that because, you know, Netanyahu is supposed to be on trial on, I think, 30 some odd charges of charges that he's indicted on, corruption charges. But this waging war against the Palestinians in Gaza, I guess, buys him more time. You know, I wanted to get the feedback of an average Israeli. And from time to time over the years, you know that I've called places. And somebody, who was it on Twitter, Bobby G., Pisces Bobby, reminded me. She said, I keep remembering the day you called someone in Israel, someone working at a hotel, and they hated Netanyahu. And I did. I called the Hotel Vera in Tel Aviv. This was a few months ago, and I forget what the exact story. Oh, it was about Netanyahu losing. So what I tend to do is call around the world, and I usually call hotels because you're going to get people there who speak English. So I take my chances. When Tahrir Square was in turmoil, I called a hotel, a Marriott, right off of Tahrir Square and got a wonderful man who was willing to talk to me. So when Netanyahu, not this last time, but the time before when Netanyahu lost the election, I called this hotel, Hotel Vera, in Tel Aviv, and I got a wonderful woman, a clerk whose name I don't remember, but she was great, and she spoke to us, and she was happy and giddy, and it looked like Netanyahu was out. But like a cat, he has all these lives. And now, just when it looked like he was out again, what does he do to save his ass? He wages war? He starts bombing Gaza again? And the other faction that was supposed to take over and form a government said, well, I'm not going to deal with this stuff with Gaza. Let him keep doing it. And this is what Netanyahu does. I firmly believe that a big part of this bombing campaign is his own plot to keep himself in office. Again, it's a guess. It's just me speaking. I'm not drawing on any facts or any intelligence to say that. It's just a feeling that I have. Anyway, I tried calling that same hotel. I did it off the air today because last time we tried calling, it just rang and it was not great radio. And a woman answered, and she's like, "Oh, I can't talk about that. I can't speak as a private citizen. You're calling the hotel and I can't talk." It was a completely different attitude than the one I got last time. And I thought, all right, I'm not going to push this. And I did try calling a couple of private numbers, but those didn't work either. So we will not be speaking with a private Israeli citizen today. But I'm not going to give up, because I believe when you speak with just average people, they want the same things we do. They don't want this crap. Then again, I could get some hardliner, crazy, right-wing religious Israeli who, you know, is just like Netanyahu. You never know. That's why I like doing these phone calls. But that's not going to happen today. Instead, I'm happy to welcome back to the show someone who's been here a few times before. Jeff Hauser is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project. Hey, Jeff, thanks for joining us today. Thanks for coming back.
It's my pleasure.
It's good to see you. I mean, the reason I invited you today was to get sort of a, you know, to take the temperature of the administration. I invited you last week, and I know you were busy last week, and I said, well, let's do it next week. That's fine. It seems like not much has really changed, but a lot has changed. The last time you and I spoke, I was talking about how I was pleasantly surprised. I did not expect much out of Joe Biden. I was not a Biden supporter during the election, during the primaries. At the beginning, I thought he was doing a pretty good job. As I said to the listeners earlier in the show, it feels like the new administration smell is wearing off, and it's being replaced by that annoying thing. Like maybe a kid left a sandwich in the back or something, and there's a stench that's starting to emanate, and you can't tell exactly where it's coming from. But we're starting to see those kind of things from the Biden administration. It's not all, wow, he's going to be the next FDR. No, he's not anymore. The first thing, because I've been talking about Israel, is his reaction to what Israel is doing. I get that, yes, Hamas was lobbing rockets at Israel indiscriminately, as they've done, but they didn't start this fight. This is the same shit over the settlements again, and the hardliner Israelis trying to push the Palestinian people out of the homes they've lived in for decades so they can settle this neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And Joe Biden's reaction right now is, we're standing with the Israelis? Did I miss something here?
Well, I don't think you're missing anything. The Biden administration is split pretty evenly between domestic and foreign policy. I think it's pretty clear that domestic policy has been better than progressive skeptics would have thought a year and a quarter ago when he took control of the primary process. But I think on foreign policy, he kind of is who he's been. Some of that is that he's always been a malleable figure on domestic policy. I think he has had a stronger sense of self on foreign policy. And that's not all bad. I mean, in terms of Afghanistan and getting out, I do think he seriously has reckoned with his vote for the war in Iraq and is less hawkish than many. But in terms of some core American foreign policy commitments in recent decades that progressives have criticized with good reason, I just don't really think this is a reformist administration. I don't think, you know, Tony Blinken is not a reformist figure. Jake Sullivan is very much not a reformist figure. Those are the two key foreign policy people in this administration. And Joe Biden was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And even when he was actually chair of Senate Judiciary, he always fashioned himself an international figure. He genuinely had relationships with a shocking number of world leaders because he prioritized learning about foreign policy and meeting the key people there. And he's long been associated with America's pro-Israel community. That doesn't only mean the worst elements of that community. I mean, I think he has relationships with J Street as well as AIPAC, but it is not surprising that he is taking a very traditionalist stance. And I think a lot of progressives have grown extremely uncomfortable with the traditional American stance of excusing anything the Israeli government does. I think that Bibi Netanyahu has kind of destroyed the patience, and that's not to say the patience was totally defensible a dozen years ago, but in 2021, there's just a disconnect between where the Democratic Party is and where the Democratic Party's foreign policy establishment is. And Biden is just very much a member of that establishment.
Right. I was astounded to see the comments and then to hear that. I want to make sure I get the facts right. So let me say it again. The UN Security Council was going to call for an immediate ceasefire, and the Biden administration blocked that. Why?
I mean, the reason is that there's a strong relationship. I'm not defending it.
Right,
I am not in any way associating myself with it. But I think that we have to recognize that America's views on this are complicated. A lot of us view it through the prism of the American Jewish community, but I don't know that that's even the key demographic group in America with respect to Israel. The Christian right in this country is also extremely emphatically biased in favor of Israel with respect to the rights of Muslims and Christians Palestine. There's a lot of anti-Arab prejudice in this country, and it's indefensible. But it's a real political force. It's not limited to American Jews. And
so many Republicans are using the, you know, one of them on TV the other day said something like, you Jews in America, you need to remember something, your homeland. That's not my homeland. I'm an American. I'm Jewish, but I'm an American. Israel, I think, has a right to exist. I'm glad it's there, but I don't like how they are ruling these days. I don't like the Netanyahu government. Same way I couldn't stand the Trump government. That needs to change. That's why I celebrated when he lost. He's lost the last four elections, and he's still in power. And I think that it may not be the only reason, but it's a big thing pushing him for hostilities because it's keeping him in power. I could be wrong, but it seems to me like he'll do anything to stay in power. So, and it's not even just a Jewish thing. I'm Jewish, criticizing. One of the, John Ossoff, our newest senator from Georgia, led one of the, he has a statement with 29 Democratic senators signing onto it, calling for a ceasefire. Bernie Sanders, I just read his op-ed from the New York Times. So it's not about American Jews who are feeling compassionate people hate what's going on over there. I want to say not in my name, and yet this government is doing it. And I think it's more the evangelical rights who think, I guess we all need to go back to Israel so the rapture can happen or something.
Yeah, and then there's just a military-industrial complex that has just acclimated itself to a close relationship between the U.S. and Israeli national security states. And there's just a close relationship that has built over decades, and those things don't change quickly.
So there's that. That's going on. But there's other stuff. And so when the Revolving Door Project, what you guys do is a big part of it is you keep tabs on who they are hiring, who is staffing up the administration. And again, the last time we spoke, we sort of celebrated the fact that we dodged a bullet with Neera Tanden and Rahm Emanuel, as much as he pushed to get a slot in the cabinet, was shut out. Well, what a difference a month or two makes. Just this week, Rahm Emanuel was named ambassador to Japan, and Neera Tanden was named a senior advisor to Joe Biden. I guess I've heard some people say with Rahm, at least he's being sent to the other side of the planet, so as far away from the United States as possible. But still, really? He's representing us in Japan?
I mean, it's a terrible choice. I mean, he covered up a racist murder. Like, and he's a corrupt political hack of the worst order, who's bad on policy. I will not say a positive word about Rahm Emanuel. I also think we can overrate the policymaking centrality of ambassadors as a class. There are people who have jobs related to Asia, East Asia in particular, within both the State Department and the National Security Council, who are vastly more influential on America's relationships with Japan and East Asia than Rom will be. So it's mostly symbolic. Again, this is not a person who deserves anything symbolic or favorable. So I'm not, and I, there is, you do develop enough high level connections that you can profit off of them. And so I do really suspect that Rom will have some form of private equity flow of money between the US and Asia or some consultancy. There's going to be some buck raking that comes out of this. So it's bad. I do want to point your attention to something that is in this area that is positive.
Okay, please. So,
so one appointment that was pivotal that progressives were very excited about was Katherine Tai to become the U.S. Trade Representative.
Yeah.
And she worked with some other forces within the Biden administration to get the U.S. government to support waiver of intellectual property rules at the WTO on COVID-19 vaccines, right, and hopefully PPE and diagnostic material testing and the like. And this is a huge deal. It's not a complete deal. It's not like everything has been transferred. The WTO is a complicated process. Mm-hmm. It's a start, not an end. But that is huge. That would have been wildly unexpected. And it does show that some of those payoffs matter. And we were focused on that. We have Revolving Door Project focus a lot more on corporate influence on the executive branch. And so we're a little more involved in that than we are, say, like Middle East policy. No, sure. I individually am appalled by U.S.'s unblinking support for BB. But the COVID-19 vaccine, like being on the right side of spreading knowledge that will allow greater production of vaccines and boosters down the line to save people's lives and to prevent against the spread of ever more dangerous variants, I that's a huge win. And I really don't think anyone would have expected that.
No, and there was a lot of pushback, too, saying that, well, that's not going to help them immediately. I mean, you're giving up their intellectual property. You should be just sending vaccines, which we are doing, too. There was an announcement made today that we're sending 20 million doses, finally, overseas. We need to do a lot more than that. But obviously, you know, getting rid of the patent protections for big pharmaceuticals so that countries can inoculate their people is a huge step, and I guess it does go against common sense the way we've always operated, that they protect the pharmaceutical companies. So I guess that is a good change in the right direction.
Yeah, and we're gonna have to be worried about COVID-19 for a few years, even as more Americans, hopefully everyone, or we get as close as possible to get vaccinated. This is not going away as a threat to us as people. And the threat to humanity that COVID-19 represents is considerable. And we need to both share vaccines in the short run before additional manufacturing can be created. We need to share and increase capacity to produce the elements that make up vaccines, because it's not like there are all sorts of elements within the vaccine in the manufacturing process. All of them need increased production, and we need to do as much as possible, and we need to share it as widely as possible. And we just have to recognize that, you know, in America, there's a good chance that we who are vaccinated, lucky enough, are going to need booster shots within a year. And that's even without variants getting worse. With the reasonable fear of variants, that might mean that this becomes kind of an annual thing, which is not the worst thing in the world. Those of us who are already getting flu shots every year, if they like stick another element in what gets hooked into my arm, it's just not that big a deal. But that's a lot. There are 7 billion people on the planet. And the notion that, you know, the capacity in America that knocks out of, you know, 10 million people back a week or something, like, we're not going to be able to produce enough for the entire planet.
No.
I think the idea that, oh my God, we might have extra production capacity in South Africa, in India, and Brazil. We as a species should only have such problems.
That's right.
That we have extra ability to produce life-saving vaccines. Because, you know, I think that might come in handy for some other issues as well down the line.
Without a doubt. By the way, Jeff Hauser, just to interrupt, my husband just handed me some breaking news. CNN just reported that Joe Biden told Netanyahu that he supports a ceasefire. Not as assertive as I would have hoped, but at least it's a step in the right direction, I suppose. Something's got to change over there. So that is good news, and hopefully we can continue on that humanitarian course, putting human lives over pharmaceutical profits. And believe me, they're still making plenty of money. We don't have to worry about that. You know, look, the vaccines are free, but I got my shot at a hospital here in Fort Lauderdale, at Holy Cross Hospital, and they did ask for my insurance card. And sure enough, they billed my insurance company $85 for each dose. So they are getting paid, you know, in case anyone was wondering. No, they're still charging and they're still paying. So Jeff Hauser is with us. So Jeff, we talked about Rahm, Neera Tanden. I thought we were done with her. I thought she was going to go back to CAP or go away. But a senior advisor, what is she? Is she Biden's Valerie Jarrett now?
I don't think she's quite that central.
I
do think that one thing that has been going on that we have been very critical of in terms of the Biden administration is they were initially very fast on making nominations and also appointments below the level requiring Senate confirmation. But there are up to 4,000 jobs in the executive branch to fill, most of which don't require Senate confirmation. And one thing that has been slowing down the process since Neera Tanden is that they are scrutinizing social media. And Nicole, one thing to keep in mind is that while Tanden is a centrist Democrat who had an acerbic Twitter feed, I would say on average, acerbic Twitter feeds are more a characteristic of the left progressive wing of the Democratic Party than the centrist.
That's true. And I'll admit, I have a tendency towards my Twitter feed being kind of acerbic, too. Just in case you're wondering.
I am like 17 different ways literally unemployable with respect to a political job. And that is my bed, and I've made it. And I'm fine with that. But let's just be aware that the more we glory in previous defeats of people on this, and just there might be some of our friends and allies who would do a terrific job in government whose path has gotten more difficult.
Right. And I just got to say, my problem with Neera Tanden is not her Twitter feed.
I think sending a message to some people that she is not, but because she was defeated because of the Twitter sensitivities of the center and right, not because of legitimate progressive concerns issues at CAP and the like. I do think there's some saying that there is life after Susan Collins's rejection or Joe Manchin's rejection is not a terrible message, because it might be a lesson that we're going to need to have imparted on behalf of people behind whom we would be more full-throated in our support.
Right. No, that's true. I just don't like her. Look, she's going to be overseeing healthcare, and I don't like her stance on she's always been against Medicare for all. She's for cutting Social Security. I have a problem with her position on issues that I care about. I don't care about her Twitter feed. I've done worse on Twitter. And I probably will continue to on a good day or bad, however you look at it. I have a problem with her now advising on healthcare issues. But nobody asked me. So there's that. So let me ask you about another one. Looking through your Twitter feed and the website at the revolvingdoorproject.org. A few things. One, and a big one, I think, United States Postal Service. Why is Louis DeJoy still there? And why have they not made a move to really replace some of these? I know the board, it's a weird setup. How does this work? And Biden just can't fire DeJoy, right?
Biden cannot directly fire DeJoy. There is a board of governors that is made up of 9 members of the board of governors plus whoever is the postmaster general serves, but they don't get to weigh in on themselves. So for purposes of the postmaster general position, there are 9 members. There are typically 5 of the president's party and 4 of the Republican Party.
Right.
Biden, not the fastest, but not the slowest, made some appointments to some vacancies. We think there's one more that he can make, because if all of Biden's picks are confirmed, we'll be at 4 Democrats and 1 independent, and then a few Republicans. And so the bold step would be to go to 5 Democrats, 1 independent, and 3 Republicans, because the statute says no more than 5 of one party. Mm-hmm. And an independent, even if they are a pro-postal service person, is not a Democrat. This is a mini nuclear option, but one that we think a lot of gamesmanship by Republicans suggests should be available to Democrats. The concerning thing is that a couple of the carryover Democrats who are there and have been are okay with Louis DeJoy. Now, some of this is that DeJoy, who's a terrible figure who should forever live in infamy, has made certain commitments. And you can imagine a weak minority on a commission or a board of governors making certain deals to try to mitigate harm. Whether or not they need to keep up those deals now that there is a Democratic majority, and given that what we have seen in terms of the degradation of the Postal Service's capacity, I mean, we very much think we can and should do better.
Yes.
And that's both on the core issues of the Postal Service, but we also think that the Postal Service should be involved in postal banking.
Yes.
We think the Postal Service could be a way, could work in conjunction with the Commerce Department to get broadband across the country. If you think about the needs of rural broadband, the Postal Service exists in literally each zip code in the country. That's kind of what makes something a zip code. And that is that the tentacles of the executive branch and the ability to have public option, be it banking or internet, to connect Americans to modern life in the 21st century. That is a very legitimate modernization of the Postal Service. It would also tend to favor the business model of the Postal Service because they have such a big infrastructure. These would just be additive to take advantage of the existing infrastructure. And I just am very skeptical of how you can move forward on those things with Louis DeJoy. And so Biden may in the end have to fire
the Democrats
as well as Republicans on the Board of Governors to get the people in place who will clean it up.
Wow. And the thing is, he doesn't have an unlimited amount of time. I mean, history tells us that the party in power loses seats in Congress in the first midterm elections that are coming up in 22. I'm going to have somebody on the show this Friday who, you know, Guy Saperstein. We're on an email list with him, and he is convinced that, and I need a dose of optimism right now, he's convinced that 2022 is going to be an amazing year for the Democrats, that it's going to be a blowout in both the House and the Senate. I don't know anyone else who feels how he does, but I'm going to let him have his say on Friday. He's going to join us on Friday. But if that doesn't happen, I mean, we're looking at the Democrats losing control of possibly both chambers of Congress. So we only have a limited amount of time to get this done. Is there enough time for him to do all this stuff? Because you have other priorities. For instance, today is tax day. And the Revolving Door Project is calling on Joe Biden to fire the IRS commissioner, Charles Rettig, who you say has spent his entire career keeping ultra-wealthy people helping them avoid paying taxes. You also say that he should fire Chris Wray. And you also talk about the Securities and Exchange Commission, who got a new progressive chair, but not so much the rest of the commission. So there's, and I, these are only a few that I picked out. I'm sure there's more. Is he going to be able to get this stuff done and the infrastructure and jobs bill through before the midterms come?
I mean, a lot of this is about organization and delegation. I mean, obviously, this can't be about, there's a famous Saturday Night Live skit in which Phil Hartman played Ronald Reagan. And the conceit of the sketch was that while Ronald Reagan played this like nice old actor guy, in reality, when the cameras were off, he was this like wheeler dealer operator who was managing the Iran-Contra scandal at a micromanaging level. And it's a hilarious sketch. Particularly because Ronald Reagan could not be doing all those things.
Right.
But even like Barack Obama, a brilliant prime of his life president, couldn't do everything by themselves. So I think the key way to think about this is that Biden can do more the more he delegates. And that's part of why personnel is policy, is that your ability to effectuate policy is putting the right people in place and then empowering them to get stuff done. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't take long to fire people. I mean, you empower the right people to help give you ideas on who should replace the people you fire. And then you give them the leeway to get stuff done for you. And you can do a lot altogether. Now in the Senate, we've also made some proposals on ways to reduce the amount of time various things take, separate from the issue of the filibuster, which we're adamantly anti-filibuster, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. That is definitely a central issue. I'm not in any way disparaging it, but there's a distinct issue of Senate confirmations and the amount of time that can be taken on the Senate floor, each nomination after another, if intransigent Republicans deny what unanimous consent. And like we all know Rand Paul exists. We all know Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz. We can't wish them away. And there are 94 U.S. attorneys. There are already 70 judicial vacancies. There are 200 ambassadorships. There are jobs up and down. And then there are jobs that you like would never even imagine, many of which are very important. Oh. And like we need to, we may need some action in the Senate so that we can just get through those confirmation fights expeditiously, and so that we're not in a situation where we're weighing, should we talk about this legislation or do some judicial nominations? Right. That should be, we can make that a false choice and do both. So some of the stuff we need Biden to trust the process, to use a sports expression, and empower his people. And some of it is we're going to need the Senate to just make sure the Republicans can't slow everything down and prevent progress. But yeah, even regardless of what you think about the 2022 elections, America faces multiple crises, and no crises should be met slowly. The whole thing about being a crisis is that we should respond as quickly as possible. So that's what we advocate.
Right. So there are also, I didn't pull the article, but I read something on the website, therevolvingdoorproject.org, about a slew of Trump policies and even regulations and plans and operational strategies that the Biden administration has not undone. There's no way to just do a blanket, you know, cancel everything they started the ball rolling on, or they have to go piece by piece? And are there things that they're like in immigration, for instance? I know there are some Trump policies that are continuing under the Obama administration that shouldn't be.
There are different tranches of policies, and depending on the type of Trump policy you're inheriting, it can be either you may or may not be able to immediately change something legally. Some regulatory processes are within the Administrative Procedure Act that require notice and comment to make in the first place and then to change. And that includes undoing Trump changes. And so some policies are hard. Other policies you can change quickly, but sometimes it's not considered normal or couth or appropriate or regular order to just unabashedly reverse everything. And it's those latter that we are most frustrated.
Yeah.
We see the central nexus of problems in the Biden administration on the domestic front. As I mentioned, on the foreign policy front, it's mostly bad with the exception of trade and thus intellectual property. Mm-hmm. Domestic policy, it's like there's a lot of good, at least especially compared to a reasonable baseline from a year ago.
Sure.
But the big exception is the Justice Department. I think Merrick Garland and some of his key acting officials, the acting Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar, the acting director of the Civil Division, a big law guy by the name of Brian Boynton, these figures are presuming to keep the large majority of Trump-era positions that they inherited. And that is bad on criminal justice, on immigrant rights, on people with student loans. It's up and down. It is a bad show at the Justice Department right now.
And this is coming from Merrick Garland or from Biden?
And I really think it's mostly Garland.
Wow.
I think that Biden believes in DOJ independence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like, the exact parameters of that are still contested, and there definitely are some skirmishes, in my understanding, between Garland and Biden on some specific DOJ appointments. Like, some issues where progressives have raised enough of a stink, I do think the White House is going to be involved. The Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust remains a mystery. That has not been picked, but we do think the White House is going to be very much involved. And there are some exceptions. They named, it wasn't Garland, but Biden who named the head of the Civil Rights Division, Kristen Clark.
Right, and she's great.
The Associate Attorney General to whom Kristen Clark will ultimately report, Vinita Gupta. And those are good appointments.
Yeah, right.
But many of the other appointments have been disappointing. And I think that it mostly reflects Merrick Garland, who is a...
He's a right winger. I mean, he's a centrist. He was the wrong person for Obama to have chosen as a Supreme Court justice. And then Biden, I guess he thought what it would be a fuck you to Mitch McConnell. I didn't understand it other than the in your face aspect of it. I didn't think it was a great choice. But what do I know? But I guess I was right.
I think that the extent to which there is a cocktail party scene in Georgetown that dictates what happens in Washington can sometimes be overstated, except with the example of Merrick Garland. Hmm. In the case of Merrick Garland, if there is somebody who has developed a tremendous bipartisan basis of support in Washington based off of being a charming guest at high-end dinner parties, it is Merrick Garland. He treats people interpersonally very well. He gets Republicans to say very nice things about him. Barack Obama thought that those very nice things would mean that he would get an up or down vote in the U.S. Senate. Barack Obama, unfortunately, a little bit like Charlie Brown, yes. Mitch McConnell being quite a lot like Lucy.
Yep.
So that didn't work. But I do think at some level, Biden, in trying to return this country to the rule of law, thought a figure well-regarded by Republican insiders would like give a sheen of bipartisan integrity to DOJ. And I think fundamentally, bipartisan sheen doesn't mean much when one political party doesn't believe in small d democracy.
Right.
Second, I think you need somebody who is willing to acknowledge what Bill Barr was, who he is, and the consequences thereof. And I think Merrick Garland has literally sat in judicial chambers. Being a circuit court judge for almost as long as AOC has been alive.
Right.
I mean,
to give you a sense of
it is a position in which people are incredibly, they suck up to you. I mean, it's just no other way to say it is a weird, distorting life. And it just bears no relationship to modern politics. And so what I've been calling Merrick Garland is that he is an unfrozen caveman Clintonite who's frozen in amber and thinks that the Republican Party of 1997, which, mind you, was about to impeach Bill Clinton on rather specious grounds.
Yep.
And it was a pretty bad Republican Party already, but he thinks it's that Republican Party or an earlier one. He just has no idea about how lawless Bill Barr's DOJ was. And he has shown no desire to move forward. I mean, they still haven't even given Trump's tax returns over to the House Ways and Means Committee.
Seriously? Oh, my God.
There's a bunch of weird matters, from the most consequential, which that is not, to the just the clearest possible issues, where they are reluctant to reverse Trump's positions.
Wow. Well, this is bigger than what I thought. This is really not good. So we need to keep up the pressure on that, I suppose, and a lot more. That's why people should check out the Revolving Door Project. TheRevolvingDoorProject.org. Jeff Hauser, thank you so much. And thank you guys for what you do over there, for staying on the case and being our watchdogs over this administration, which, you know, despite all the PR, hey, he's more progressive than we thought. Not quite. And the sheen is starting to come off the new car shine. So we'll try to keep him honest. It's more of the same, but I'm glad you're there watching out. Jeff Hauser, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, okay. You take care. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, and with that, we're done. You know, just when you think things are getting better, well, in some respects, I guess they are, but not enough. Certainly not enough, and not quickly enough.